Chapter 3 Last Days at Home. Inside the house there was still much activity. Tea was still being consumed in huge quantities, and food was disappearing as last-minute revelers fortified themselves against the coming night. All the rooms were occupied, and there was no room for me. Disconsolately, I wandered round, idly kicking at stones and anything else in the way, but even that did not bring inspiration. No one took any notice of me. The guests were tired and happy, the servants were tired and irritable. The horses have more feeling, I grumbled to myself. I will go and sleep with them. The stables were warm, and the fodder was soft, but for a time sleep would not come. Each time I dozed, a horse would nudge me, or a sudden burst of sound from the house would rouse me. Gradually the noises were stilled. I raised myself to one elbow and looked out. The lights were one by one flickering to blackness. Soon there was only the cold blue moonlight reflecting vividly from the snow-capped mountains. The horses slept, some on their feet and some on their sides. I, too, slept. The next morning I was awakened by a rough shake and a voice saying to me, "Come along, Tuesday Lobsang. I have got to get the horses ready, and you are in the way." So I got up and made my way into the house in search of food. There was much activity. People were preparing to leave, and Mother was flitting from group to group for a last-minute chat. Father was discussing improvements to the house and to the gardens. He was telling an old friend of his that he intended having glass imported from India so that our house would have glazed windows. In Tibet there was no glass, none was made in the country, and the cost of bringing it from India was very high indeed. Tibetan windows have frames upon which is stretched paper, which is highly waxed and translucent, but not transparent. Outside, the windows were heavy wooden shutters, not so much to keep burglars away as to prevent the ingress of grit carried by the strong winds. This grit, sometimes it was more like small pebbles, would tear through any unprotected windows. It would also deeply cut exposed hands and faces, and during the season of strong winds, such journeys were fraught with danger. The people of Lhasa used to keep a wary eye upon the peak, and when it suddenly became hidden in a black haze, everyone used to dash for shelter before the whipping, blood-bringing wind caught them. But not only humans were on the alert, animals also were on the watch, and it was no unusual sight to see horses and dogs leading the humans in the rush for shelter. Cats were never caught in a storm, and yaks were quite immune. With the departure of the last of the guests, I was called before Father, who said, "Go to the shopping center and buy your needs. Tzu knows what is required." I thought of the things I would need: a sampa bowl made of wood, a cup, and a rosary. The cup would be in three parts: a stand, the cup, and its lid. This would be of silver. The rosary would be of wood, with its 108 beads highly polished. 108, the sacred number, also indicates the things which a monk has to remember. we set off, Sue on his horse and I on my pony. As we left the courtyard, we turned right, later turning right again as we left the ring road past the patala to enter the shopping center. I looked about me as if seeing the town for the first time. I was greatly afraid that I was seeing it for the last time. The shops were crowded with chauffeuring merchants who had just arrived in Lhasa. Some were bringing tea from China, and others had brought cloth from India. We made our way through the crowd to the shops we wished to visit. Every so often, Sue would call out a greeting to some old friend of former years. I had to get a robe of russet red. I was going to have it rather on the large size, not merely because I was growing, but for an equally practical reason. In Tibet, men wear voluminous robes which are tied tightly at the waist. The upper portion is pulled up and forms a pouch, which is the repository for all those items which the Tibetan male finds it necessary to carry. The average monk, for instance, will carry in this pouch his sampa bowl, cup, a knife, various amulets, a rosary, a bag of roasted barley, and, not infrequently, a supply of sampa. But remember, a monk carries upon his person all his worldly possessions. My pathetic little purchases were rigidly supervised by Tzu, who permitted only the barest essentials, and those of merely mediocre quality as befitted a poor acolyte. They included sandals with yak leather soles, a small leather bag for roasted barley, a wooden sampa bowl, wooden cup, not the silver affair I had hoped for, and a carving knife. This, together with a very plain rosary, which I had to polish myself, were to be my only possessions. Father was a millionaire several times over, with huge estates all over the country, with jewels and indeed much gold, but I, while I was training, while Father lived, I was to be just a very poor monk. I looked again at the street, at those two-storied buildings with the long projecting eaves. I looked again at the shops with shark's fins and the saddle covers displayed on the booths outside their doors. I listened once more to the cheerful banter of the traders and their customers haggling good-naturedly over the prices to be paid. This street had never looked more attractive, and I thought of the fortunate people who saw it every day and would continue to see it every day. Stray dogs ambled around, sniffing here and there, exchanging growls. Horses neighed softly to each other as they awaited the pleasure of their masters. Yaks groaned throatily as they meandered through the pedestrian throng. What mysteries lurked behind those paper-covered windows? What wonderful stores of goods from all parts of the world had passed through those sturdy wooden doors? And what tales those open shutters would tell if they could speak? All this I gazed upon as upon an old friend. It did not occur to me that I would ever see these streets again, even though but rarely. I thought of the things I would have liked to have done, of the things I would have liked to buy. My reverie was shatteringly interrupted. A hand, immense and menacing, descended upon me, caught my ear and twisted it fiercely, while the voice of Tzu bellowed for all the world to hear. "Come on, Tuesday Lamsang, are you dead on your feet? I don't know what boys are coming to nowadays. Wasn't like this when I was a lad." Zhu did not seem to mind if I stayed behind without my ear, or retained it by following him. There was no choice but to come on. All the way home, Zhu rode ahead, mumbling and moaning about the present generation, good-for-nothing lot, bone-idle layabouts, living in a daze. At least there was one bright spot. As we turned into the Lingor Road, there was quite a bitter wind. Zhu's great bulk ahead of me gave me a sheltered path. At home, my mother had a look at the things which I had bought. To my regret, she agreed that they were good enough. I had been cherishing the hope that she would overrule Zhu and say that I could have better quality articles. So once again, my hopes of having a silver cup were shattered, and I had to make do with the wooden one turned on a hand lathe in the bazaars of Lhasa. I was not to be left alone for my last week. Mother dragged me round to other big houses in Lhasa so that I could pay my respects. Not that I was feeling respectful. Mother reveled in the journeyings, in the interchange of social conversation, and in the polite tittle-tattle which made up the everyday round. I was bored stiff. To me, all this was a genuine ordeal, as I was definitely not born with the attributes which makes one suffer fools gladly. I wanted to be out in the open, enjoying myself for the few days remaining. I wanted to be out flying my kites, jumping with my pole, practicing archery, instead of which I had to be dragged around like a prize yak, being shown off to frumpish old women who had nothing to do all day but to sit on silk cushions and call for a servant in order to gratify their slightest whim. But it was not only Mother who caused me so much heartburning. Father had to visit the Drepung Lamasery, and I was taken along to see the place. Drepung is the largest lamasery in the world, with its 10,000 monks, its high temples, little stone houses, and terraced buildings rising tier upon tier. This community was like a walled town, and like a good town, it was self-supporting. Drepung means rice heap, and from a distance it did look like a heap of rice, with the towers and domes gleaming in the light. Just at this time, I was not in a good mood to appreciate architectural beauties. I was feeling distinctly glum at having to waste precious time like this. Father was busy with the abbot and his assistants, and I, like a waif of the storm, wandered disconsolately around. It made me shiver with fright when I saw how some of the small novices were treated. The rice heap was really seven lamasaries in one, seven distinct orders, seven separate colleges formed its composition. It was so large that no man was in charge. 14 abbots ruled here, and stern disciplinarians they were. I was glad when this pleasant jaunt across a sunlit plain, to quote Father, came to an end, but more glad to know that I was not going to be consigned to Drepung or to Sera, 3 miles north of Lhasa. At last, the week drew to an end. My kites were taken from me and given away. My bows and beautifully feathered arrows were broken to signify that I was no longer a child and had no use for such things. I felt that my heart, too, was being broken, but no one seemed to think that important. At nightfall, Father sent for me, and I went to his room, with its wonderful decorations and the old and valuable books lining the walls. He sat by the side of the main altar, which was in his room, and bade me kneel before him. This was to be the ceremony of the opening of the book. In this large volume, some 3 feet wide by 12 inches long, were recorded all the details of our family for centuries past. It gave the names of the first of our line and gave details of the deeds which caused them to be raised to the nobility. Recorded here were the services we had done for our country and for our ruler. Upon the old yellow pages I read history. Now, for the second time, the book was opened for me. First it had been to record my conception and birth. Here were the details upon which the astrologers based their forecasts. Here were the actual charts prepared at the time. Now I had to sign the book myself, for tomorrow a new life for me would start when I entered the lamasery. The heavy carved wooden covers were slowly replaced, the golden clasps pressing the thick handmade sheets of juniper paper were clipped on. The book was heavy. Even Father staggered a little beneath its weight as he rose to replace it in the golden casket which was its protection. Reverently, he turned to lower the casket into the deep stone recess beneath the altar. Over a small silver brazier, he heated wax, poured it upon the stone lid of the recess, and impressed his seal so that the book would not be disturbed. He turned to me and settled himself comfortably on his cushions. A touch of a gong at his elbow, and a servant brought him buttered tea. There was a long silence, and then he told me of the secret history of Tibet. History going back thousands and thousands of years. A story which was old before the flood. He told me of the time when Tibet had been washed by an ancient sea, and of how excavations had proved it. Even now, he said, anyone digging near Lhasa could bring to light fossilized sea animals and strange shells. There were artifacts, too, of strange metal and unknown purpose. Often, the monks who visited certain caves in the district would discover them and bring them to Father. He showed me some. Then his mood changed. Because of the law, to the high-born shall be shown austerity, while to the low shall be shown compassion, he said. You will undergo a severe ordeal before you are permitted to enter the lamasery. He enjoined upon me the utter necessity of implicit obedience to all commands which would be given to me. His concluding remarks were not conducive to a good night's sleep. He said, "My son, you think I am hard and uncaring, but I care only for the name of the family. I say to you, if you fail in this test for entry, do not return here. You will be as a stranger to this household." With that, with no further word, he motioned me to leave him. Earlier in the evening, I had said my farewells to my sister Yasso. She had been upset, for we had played together so often, and she was now but 9 years of age, while I would be 7 tomorrow. Mother was not to be found. She had gone to bed, and I was not able to say goodbye to her. I made my lonely way to my own room for the last time, and arranged the cushions which formed my bed. I lay down, but not to sleep. For a very long time I lay there thinking of the things my father had told me that night, thinking of the strong dislike father had for children, and thinking of the dreaded morrow when, for the first time, I would sleep away from home. Gradually the moon moved across the sky. Outside, a nightbird fluttered on the windowsill. From the roof above came the flap-flap of prayer flags slapping against bare wooden poles. I fell asleep, but as the first feeble rays of the sun replaced the light of the moon, I was awakened by a servant and given a bowl of sampa and a cup of buttered tea. As I was eating this meager fare, Sue bustled into the room. "Well, boy," he said, "our ways part. Thank goodness for that. Now I can go back to my horses. But acquit yourself well. Remember all that I have taught you." With that, he turned upon his heel and left the room. Although I did not appreciate it at the time, this was the kindest method. Emotional farewells would have made it very much more difficult for me to leave home. For the first time, forever, as I thought. If Mother had been up to see me off then, no doubt I should have tried to persuade her to allow me to remain at home. Many Tibetan children have quite soft lives. Mine was hard by any standard, and the lack of farewells, as I later found, was on Father's orders, so that I should learn discipline and firmness early in life. I finished my breakfast, tucked my sampa bowl and cup into the front of my robe, and rolled a spare robe and a pair of felt boots into a bundle. As I crossed the room, a servant bade me to go softly and not waken the sleeping household. Down the corridor I went. The false dawn had been replaced by the darkness that comes before the true dawn as I made my way down the steps and onto the road. So I left my home, lonely, frightened, and sick at heart. End of chapter 3.